Second case, Weigel v. SPX Corporation, 12-3024. And Mr. Hansen.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Larry Hansen. May it please the Court, Counsel. I represent the plaintiffs below, Mr. and Mrs. Weigel, and Mr. and Mrs. Moore. In essence, what we have here, Your Honors, is a product liability case where the allegations are those of design defect and failure to warn, which results in not a strict liability standard, but rather a negligence standard. If I could summarize generally the record as presented to the district court and now this court, plaintiffs contended that jack stands manufactured by the defendant or the appellee were negligently designed and an inadequate warning, and presented expert testimony in support of that as well. Defendants submitted evidence to the contrary, that there was not a defective design and that the warnings were adequate. I believe that simply creates an issue of fact. Plaintiffs filed the complaint, answer was served, discovery was undertaken, expert testimony and opinion testimony was solicited, summary judgment was filed, and Judge McKinney granted the summary judgment, we believe erroneously. We are here seeking a reversal of that order and a remand back to the district court for trial. We believe there's five errors associated with the granting of summary judgment. The first error was finding that the content of the warning contained on the jack stand was sufficient as a matter of law. We believe that was to be was an error. We also believe that the district court distinguished the Cook decision, Cook versus Ford. We believe that that distinguishing was inappropriate. We believe that the district court found the Marshall forklift case to be dispositive in this case. We also believe that was an overreaching of Marshall. In effect, the fourth error dovetails into the Marshall error. We believe that the decision that the warning was adequate eviscerates the defective design claim, even though those are two separate and distinct claims. And finally, we believe that based upon the defendant's or SPX's testimony and a lack of a genuine issue of material fact, we believe that misuse is not even a defense in this case, that there is no misuse, because the use at issue was foreseeable by both the engineering manager and the designer of the jack stand, both SPX employees. Very briefly on the facts, I'm quite sure the court's familiar with the facts. If I could make an analogy, this is a jack stand, not like the jack stand probably in most people's home. This is a heavy-duty jack stand. The way I would describe it is if you were to take a funnel, invert the funnel, and then place a straw through the inverted funnel. There is a standard through the industry, PALD 4 2.2. It's portable automotive lifting devices is PALD. That standard indicates that straw shall not pass past the base of the funnel. In other words, the straw should not hit the ground or should not hit the table. The reason that standard exists, according to everyone with knowledge as to the design of these stands, is to not create instability. In other words, if the straw hits the ground, the load is being maintained by the straw, not by the funnel. And that's what happened in this case. Now, SPX, the plaintiff has taken the position that violates the standard and establishes the defective design. SPX takes the position that because the pin was not used in the straw, that would prevent the straw from hitting the ground. That saves a violation of the standard and corrects the alleged defect of design.
What does Indiana law require with respect to the specificity of the warning?
I believe that the warning...
Does it have to tell you about the consequences of following the particular a warning or what the consequences of a misuse are?
I believe it does, Your Honor. The warning duty, a manufacturer is required to provide adequate instruction for safe use and provide a warning as to the dangers inherent as to the improper use. So,
now,
in other words,
in the industry, is this design with the pin?
Yes, sir.
Is this unique to this particular brand?
I don't believe a pin is unique, but what is unique is the straw or center column passing past the plane of the base. In other words, the evidence elicited in this case was this was the only jack stand anyone was aware of that this happened with. In other words, it was extremely unique, but not necessarily a pin setting, but for the center column to extend past the base. So there were other jack stands in the industry that had a funnel design or had a spun base, is what they call it, with a center column, but none that passed that depth. And the reason SPX indicates that this is unique and different is because there was a need in the field to have height. We indicated that, well, there were many alternatives you could have done to obtain that height without still, in our opinion, violating the standard. So, in answer to the court's question, pinned devices are not unique, but the center column passing past the plane of the base is.
With respect to warning of the consequences, the warning here says something to the effect that to prevent personal injury, you're always to use the support pin, and support pin has to go completely through the extension tube. Doesn't that tell the user that the consequence of not doing that risks personal injury?
I think that's an argument. I think that certainly is an issue that a fact finder could find. However, as we look at the label says to prevent personal injury, colon, and then gives us a listing of items. Always using the pin has nothing to do with the usage of safety glasses, yet it's still contained therein. The specificity of, hey, this pin is an integral part of this jack stand, and without this pin, it is inherently unstable and unreasonably dangerous.
So I'm sorry. What needed to be said was that you don't use the pin, this thing becomes inherently stable and falls on you. That's your point?
I believe so, yes. You don't use the pin, you don't have a jack stand. Every end user that testified in this case indicated, well, the pin's to adjust height. That was their understanding. Now, it's clear in the record, Weigel didn't read the instruction. However, Moore did, and Moore still thought the pin was to adjust for height. So that goes to the adequacy of the warning. That goes to the reasonableness of the design. That goes to the design defect. It's beyond dispute that Weigel didn't read it. That leads us into the read and heed discussions. But we know what a reasonable interpretation...
Don't the Indiana cases support that concept that an instruction will be read and heeded?
There are older cases that discuss the read and heed exception. However, I think if we look at the most recent case, Cook seems to tell us comment J under the restatement is the read and heed. If we look at the current statute for Indiana products liability law, we see that comment J has not been adopted by Indiana, although case law has implemented it. But when we finally get to Cook, we see read and heed, where there was not a reading of the warning, and the court said, well, but we don't know that that would have made a difference. So the way I've interpreted that is you have to take a look at the warning and make sure it's an adequate warning. If there's an adequate warning, I believe there's an argument that there's a presumption. I think there's also an argument that there's not.
And the jury would have to decide.
I think so, Your Honor.
And a jury in this case, for example, could take this warning and say it's inadequate, and another jury could say it was adequate.
Absolutely. My dad, the Marine Corps drill instructor, would have said, it told you to do that. Why didn't you do that? And that's up to the jury to decide. I don't think it's for the
court. And what does the company do after it's gotten the two verdicts?
I'm sorry.
What does the company that wrote the warning do after they've gotten these two verdicts? One saying the warning's fine and the other saying the warning's bad.
I think since this is such a unique jack stand, the company, I would hope, rewrites its warning and says, or makes a
and
safe
makes the
design.
Warning longer?
I'm sorry?
And makes the warning longer, more precise?
Tells you the exact, or tells you specifically what happens if you don't use the pin, that you don't have a jack stand. But that alone still doesn't make the jack stand safe.
Well, no, I understand the design issue.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't understand your warning argument.
Okay.
But I understand the design.
My issue relative to the warning issue is I don't believe that the warning is adequate. Since this is different than every other jack stand on the market and doesn't behave as every other jack stand on the market, the warning has to communicate to the end user that which an ordinary user would know regarding the ordinary characteristics of the product. Since this is so unique, the warning has to be much more specific. The warning has to tell you, without this pin, you don't have a jack stand. I guarantee it's going to fall. But the evidence regarding the amount of force was staggering, the difference between the amount of force required. We believe that the summary judgment was inappropriate on all of those bases. I see where I'm going into my rebuttal time, but just to speak as to the design defect quickly, I concur that the law is very clear that a safer alternative doesn't mean the manufacturer has to do that, but just because there's an alternative doesn't make the first version safe. And I think that was the leap that Judge McKinney took. Since we had a different alternative, which we were required to present, that presupposed that the original design was fine, which is not what our evidence was. Our evidence was that this original design was defective, and here's a safe version, not a safer version. So, Your Honors, we ask that the summary judgment be reversed and that this be remanded back to the district court. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Springer?
Hey, police court, my name is Steve Springer. I'm here on behalf of defendant SPX. I'm accompanied by my partner, Mark Girth. I'd like to make an initial point with respect to the evidence before we get into discussing the law. As we reviewed the record up on appeal, I'm hopeful that you've had an opportunity to look at the CD, which has the video testimony of both Mr. Weigel and Mr. Moore as they describe how they utilized this piece of equipment. As in so many cases, a picture is worth a thousand words and a little video is worth more than that. It is important that the court realize that this product consists of basically three parts, as Mr. Hansen mentioned. We have a conical base, which is about 18 inches in diameter. We have a shaft, which is about 3 inches in diameter, which fits down into the conical base. And it has a series of holes in it and a pin. And this isn't just some hat pin. It's a pin that's of strong structural steel that is approximately half an inch in diameter, about 6 inches long, and that is utilized to regulate the height of the support stand. I may fall into the same trap that counsel did of calling this a jack stand. This is not a jack stand at all. A jack stand is something where you can utilize some kind of a lever and ratchet it up, and I think we've all jumped into that shorthand, but this is not a jack stand at all. Now, if you utilize the product with two out of three parts, probably isn't going to work. If you just utilize the base without the shaft, you're not utilizing the product. If you're utilizing this product without putting in the pin, it isn't going to work. Nothing's holding things up. The point that counsel makes with respect to the fully extended versus fully retracted position comes within the testing procedures contained within the PALD, which is a standard which he reflected. These stands are required to withstand something like 100, well, they are required to withstand 150% of their design load. These particular stands are 12-ton stands, therefore they're tested to 18 tons, and therefore to make sure they don't collapse. Well, that obviously isn't going to work if you don't put in the pin. I mean, nothing's going to hold up at all. That is the genesis of the term fully extended, which means you're going to have it as high as possible. When it's down as low as possible, this stand reaches about my hip. It's about
as low as possible without the pin in, or as low as possible?
As low as possible with the pin in is about equal to my hip. As low as possible without the pin in is less than a quarter of an inch less than that. And that is exactly the point I would like for you to note as you look at the video. This explanation that we did it so that we could gain some kind of a mechanical advantage doesn't make any sense, because you're talking about, frankly, about an eighth of an inch, something less than a quarter of an inch. You can still see the hole when it's down without the pin in it, but you can't get the pin in there because it's not in alignment, if I answered your question.
The difference in terms of the stability is substantial.
Sure. There's no stability at all. You're basically balancing this thing up on top of the shaft, which is now down, in this case, on the concrete floor. And you can tell this by just using your hand. And part of the instructions, as the court will notice, is that as you go through this, you're supposed to make sure that things are stable. It says that in numerous places. You can just take your hand and wobble it like that. There's nothing, no connection between the two. It's just down in a hole. I hopefully answer your question, Judge Tinner.
Manufacturers who do not use a pin, how do they attain stability?
Well, now you're talking about jack stands.
No, I'm talking about other people who make products.
They do.
Like
the comparable product would be to use the pins, and they do use the pins, and they're stable.
See. I see.
But the other products have some sort of sleeve or something that goes in, somehow prevents the tube from reaching ground level.
I'm not aware of any such product, and I don't think there's any evidence of that in the record. So in this case, the plaintiff admits that the cause of the accident is a failure to use the pin, not an issue. The plaintiff admits that the pin was not used, so that's no factual question there. And the plaintiff admits that they did not follow the instructions, either because they didn't read them or because they consciously decided to do something different to gain some kind of a mechanical advantage. The plaintiff contends that a manufacturer has a duty to anticipate that its most basic warnings and instructions would be either not read at all or would be ignored, and that the manufacturer then has a duty to design its product with that in mind. And that just simply is not the law at all. The law is replete with cases where it is anticipated that the user will read the instructions, pay attention to them, and use them and follow them. This accident occurred because they didn't use the pin. And as I've just discussed, if you don't use all three parts, it just simply isn't going to work. I liken their argument to a virtual three-legged stool where actually none of the legs quite meets the ground. The first being that they didn't use the pin. They didn't use all three parts. And so they're not really using the product as it is reasonably designed to be used. They similarly argued that the instructions and the warnings were not reasonably understandable. The warnings, as the court, I believe, has pointed out to Mr. Hansen, are quite clear. To prevent personal injury, always use the pin. And it's not hidden. It's in there multiple times in the instructions and actually on a decal on the product itself. And as the court will notice, there is a pictogram, a little cartoon, which shows a guy being crushed as part of that, indicating what the personal injury would be. Now, it's interesting.
The pictogram is adjacent to the warning about exceeding the weight capacity or the rating capacity. Isn't that right?
As counsel points out, there's a number of warnings, and there are several pictograms. There's a little triangle with an exclamation point. There's this pictogram. I don't know how anybody could read that and be confused as to what applies to what, but then we're back to it doesn't make any difference because they didn't read it, and if they did read it, they consciously ignored it. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but it's a matter of how do you get a decal lined up with what is what. And anybody thinks the crushing injury could occur because of failure to wear safety glasses, I don't think that's a reasonable argument, Your Honor.
Well, isn't there some testimony from an employee of SPX that the pictogram was placed near the capacity rating warning so that it would apply to that?
Well, it does apply to that. It applies in multiple circumstances, but if you put 70 tons worth of stuff on a 12-ton support stand, you're going to get a crushing injury, and the pictogram would apply.
Right.
So I think that was the context of his testimony.
Right. So if it's there for that aspect of the warning, how is it you say it's also there for use of the support pin, that the pictogram has application to that?
I just think that's a matter of semantics, Your Honor. There's only so many cartoons you can put on this decal without completely wallpapering the thing with warnings and instructions. It says specifically, always use to prevent personal injury, always use the pin. And the pictogram is down one line or so from there. I don't remember. You know, you can see on the decal itself. But the bigger concern, frankly, it shouldn't be that big of a concern as to whether or not people are going to put the pin in, because that's what it tells you to do, and a manufacturer is entitled to expect the user to read and heed the instructions. Similarly, the manufacturer would expect that they're not going to exceed the design load, but that's probably a more prescient concern, that somebody's going to try to put 15 tons, 20 tons on this stand, and that's a bigger worry. Hopefully I've answered your question in that regard. I alluded to the three-legged stool. The third leg, which doesn't quite reach the ground, is it really doesn't make any difference, because counsel has admitted here an argument and admitted it throughout, Mr. Weigel did not read the instructions. Mr. Moore says he's read them, but he didn't do the things that he was supposed to do that day, and evidently made some conscious decision to seek this height advantage by not using the pin. And credibility shouldn't be an issue here, but that just doesn't make any sense at all. The law is that manufacturers are entitled to expect users to read and heed the instructions and warnings. The fact that this is not specifically mentioned in the Indiana Products Liability Act has been brought out numerous times in cases since then, and those cases are cited. It is discussed in the Cook versus Ford case. There's the Daisy BB gun case that specifically sets that out, and that Daisy BB gun case is cited numerous times in later cases.
Let's suppose for a minute that the notice is inadequate, but you never read it.
I'm sorry, I missed. Is what?
It is that it is inadequate. Let's just suppose that. Arguendo. Let's suppose that the man still never read it. Can you tell me about your view on the proximate cause issue?
Then the condition of the warning, which you posit as being inadequate, is not a proximate cause of the accident at all, because nobody paid attention to it.
What have the Indiana courts said about that?
That they agree with that, and I believe that that's reflected in Judge McKinney's opinion. It is addressed. I'm going to come to the Barnard versus Saturn opinion in just a second, which goes into that very issue, and the court holds differently, and I'll go ahead and raise that now because I recognize that this is a de novo hearing. Below, we argued that that case, Barnard versus Saturn, is applicable, and that the plaintiff could only reasonably be found by a reasonable jury would be found to be more than 50% at fault as a matter of law, and under Indiana Products Liability Act would not recover. In that case, the fellow was trying to change the oil in his car. He jacked the car up on this jack, which had all kinds of warnings on the instructions, on the thing that it was in. Don't do this. And sure enough, it fell on him and killed him. And the court, rather than addressing it as a matter of proximate cause, which frankly makes more sense to me because the fact that it fell on him was not proximately caused by the condition in the warnings, but they rather attacked it as being that he was more than 50% at fault as a matter of law and ruled that way. So I would submit an answer to your question that if you don't read the instructions, you can't very well say I was injured approximately because of the condition of the instructions, which I think is what you're positing.
Yes.
I believe that Judge McKinney appreciated the basic fact pattern, the basic law. We've just now talked about the de novo review. This is a very straightforward case. The warnings are clearly adequate. The manufacturer is entitled to believe or to expect that a user is going to read and heed the instructions, and it is inappropriate to make a manufacturer go out and try to design a product in anticipation that its product will not be used in the manner in which it instructs to use. If you're going to do that, then you enter into an entirely new ballgame of trying to think up all the different ways that people can misuse your product and perhaps put a warning, don't use this upside down, don't use it on a hill, it goes on and on. And it doesn't apply just to support stands, but all sorts of products, including medical products, drugs, etc. The courts have been quite straightforward with respect to the aspect that warnings are expected to be read and heeded, and that the product is not defective if the warning would have taken care of the problem.
A concern I have is whether there's evidence in this record that would show that SPX had some reason to think that the product could be used in the way that the plaintiffs did here, and yet put it into the stream of commerce with the Indiana Code providing that a product is defective if it would be unreasonably dangerous to the expected user or consumer when used in reasonably expectable ways of handling or consumption. So if they had some anticipation that it would be used without the pin and yet put it out there, doesn't it still fit the Indiana definition of an unreasonably dangerous product?
I believe this very point that you're raising was addressed in one of the cases, and it may have been the Gardner case and Judge Pratt, but I'm not sure. But if you look at any warning, it anticipates that, almost by definition, that somebody could do that. And so there's two ways of saying it. You stick your head in the sand and say, I can't anticipate anybody would do anything, therefore I don't have to worry about it. Or you can try to think up ways that people can misuse your product and issue a warning accordingly. The very fact that you issue a warning or instruction, I suppose by definition, anticipate or says that you've anticipated somebody could do such a thing. Wear safety glasses. It anticipates that somebody wouldn't wear safety glasses. Anticipates you could somehow poke yourself in the eye. It doesn't have anything to do with this case. Some of my analogies are weak here. But if you go on the idea that just because you thought up a warning, therefore you've anticipated they're going to do something wrong, and therefore it's not a misuse or it's a foreseeable misuse of the product, which gets you around the precepts of the product liability law, doesn't make any sense. The concept is that it is reasonably expected that you will follow the instructions, and so it's misuse of the product in a reasonably anticipated use of the product. So I hopefully that's answered your question, Your Honor. I have extra time, but I think one of the basic rules, if you don't have anything else to say, and this is very straightforward, is you sit down, and that's what I anticipate doing at this point, if that's all right with you.
All right. Hanson, how much time? 4 minutes.
I respect Mr. Springer quite a bit, and I appreciate getting a preview of his closing argument. That's exactly what this is. It establishes the questions of fact that exist in this case. They only gained an eighth of an inch. That just doesn't make sense. Well, that's a factual argument to the fact finder. Moore says he believed that the pin was for height adjustments of the center column after reading the instructions. So there's a factual question of whether or not that warning was adequate. That doesn't even touch upon whether or not the product is unreasonably dangerous under the separate and distinct cause of action of design defect. But the most telling part for argument to this court, we hear, if you don't use all parts, it just won't work. Where's that on the warning label? If it's so clear, if this warning label is so clear that appears at page 15 of the Appellee's brief, why is that not on there? That label says to prevent personal injury, bullet point one, little cartoon with somebody reading, understand and follow all instructions, so on and so forth. Bullet point two, little cartoon, safety glasses, wear eye protection. Bullet point three, little crushing cartoon, do not exceed rating capacity. Clearly, that's what these are for. Then we continue on. Positions stand on smooth, level surface. Soft or irregular surfaces may not provide adequate support, and stand may tip. We know how to tell you what you do may result in a tipping of the stand and create instability. Next, always use the support pin, semicolon. Insert support pin completely through the extension tube. Extension tube, not support tube. Support pin, yes. Okay. So what does that mean? Well, if you don't put it all the way through, maybe it cocks. Maybe it could get jammed. Never says it's you don't have a jack stand. It is inherently unstable. It will tip. It will fall. It doesn't say that at all. Center the load on the support stand. Do not use it on the raised portion of the pad, which doesn't have anything to do in this case. There's a saddle with two buckles, and that's what that's talking about. Block the wheels to prevent movement. Well, there's no wheels on this. The trailer's got the wheels taken off, and it's on the sand pads on the front. That's not even applicable in this case. Read and heed. We keep hearing about read and heed. The problem with read and heed is it only applies, I believe, it only applies if the warning is adequate. This warning is inadequate. And then it still doesn't even address how summary judgment is granted on a design defect when we've indicated that the very design is defective in and of itself. And both Schoenoff and Bechter from SPX said that it was foreseeable that this misuse, in quotes, would happen at the time this stand was designed. So they knew it when they put it in the stream of commerce. The summary judgment should not have been granted. Again, we ask you to reverse and remand.
But your position is,
yes, sir,
the warning is inadequate.
Yes, sir.
Unless you specify consequences.
Specific
Because there's nothing equivocal about this language. The language is always use the support pin. Insert support pin completely through extension tip.
That is what it states. It does not tell you what the result is. That is an instruction. That is not a warning.
So if they said, if you don't do this, you could die, that would be enough? Or do you actually have to go through the mechanics of what might happen?
I think they need to address what the risk is, and the risk is the instability. They've demonstrated they know how to do that on this label, and I think it needed to be there. Because these mechanics, used to the industry, used to the standards, thought that that pin was to adjust height, despite reading it or not. And
so you might not need the graphic examples.
I don't think
you have to do this, otherwise it might not be stable.
I believe so.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case up.